Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is New York State Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb, a Republican who represents the 129th District. Kolb has served in the Assembly since the year 2000. Minority Leader Kolb, we're flattered to have you here. Welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure.
So, what's it like being a part of a small minority in an overwhelmingly Democratic Assembly?
Interesting, rewarding, challenging. And certainly the numbers of our members have increased since I became leader. We've won seats that we had never won before. Mm-hmm. So our numbers are going up, which is the right direction. And we're proud of that. Plus, we're proud of the work we do in terms of holding any minority party or whoever's in the minority. Your job is to hold the majority accountable. And
Brian,
that's what we do.
Remind everybody what you did before you became an assemblyman.
Sure. I actually came from the private sector. I spent over 25 years in manufacturing, owned my own business with my three partners.
What was it?
The name of the company was North American Filter Corporation, and we were based in Newark, New York, which is in Wayne County, which is in western New York, or Finger Lakes. And I was in that in the filter business, which is industrial filters for air, gas, liquid applications from an industrial perspective all across the country and also internationally. And again, I work for also small and large technology firms. So I was in the industrial filtration business. And then the last 6 years before I went into state government, I was in this porous ceramic filtration business, which was also in Wayne County.
And porous ceramic does what? It filters water? Or
Water, air. Usually ceramic materials are used in very corrosive atmospheres and also very high temperatures. Ceramic is very resilient. That's what the tiles are made out of on the space shuttle is ceramic because it can withstand very high temperatures. And also, it's a very it's much better in a corrosive environment than stainless steel or even titanium is.
So how would you compare being the legislative leader in your party, the Republican Party, with running a business?
Well, certainly it's, believe it or not, much more difficult to be a legislative leader. You've got
herding cats.
Well, herding cats, but also you're dealing with so many different audiences. You're dealing with, obviously, the institution itself. You're dealing with staff. You're dealing with elected officials in both the Senate and the Assembly. Obviously, the governor, regardless who's the governor, you're dealing with the governor and his staff. You're dealing with the media, and everything is scrutinized and criticized no matter what you do. And then, of course, that doesn't count the amount of hours and travel. I travel all across the state. I have offices in Buffalo and New York City. Most people don't realize that.
270 Broadway?
250.
250 Broadway.
250 Broadway. And I mean, it's
an awful building. It's just so depressing.
Well, it's actually gotten a little better. It's not bad.
Oh, they fixed it up a bit?
Yeah, they fixed it up a bit. Okay. And it's right across from City Hall.
I know it well. Yeah. I used to work in the legislature, too. I used to work for the minority leader of the New York State Senate, Fred Orenstein. And so I had a little office down there, too. I always found it a little off-putting, but maybe they have fixed it up.
Well, it's not lavish suites, that's for sure.
Right. Okay. So now, you know, because when you're the boss of a business, you say, you know, do it or you're fired. You really can't do that here, right?
That's correct. I mean, certainly when I was president of Refractron Technologies, I was also the chief operating officer. You had full P&L profit and loss responsibility and making goal every month and trying to get our organization all moving in the same way. But if you had some folks that weren't cooperating or being part of the team, you could obviously make it known or make it easy to be known that their presence was no longer necessary. Where in the legislative side, you got to do a lot of controlling, a lot of gnawing on the inside of your gum, keep your tongue in control. It's just the nature of the business, which is more difficult because I'm a very direct and outspoken guy.
Yes, you are, which I admire. Now, what was the impetus to get you out of running the firm and into the legislature?
Well, it's interesting. While I was serving in my leadership capacities in the private sector, I was very involved with community boards, which I always enjoyed. And I've been interested in government and politics going way back to when John F. Kennedy was president of the United States. And that was my first, as a kid, introduction to, through the TV, obviously, and going back to, even to when President Kennedy was assassinated. And just over time, I'd just always got this inane interest in government and politics. And it just increased and increased. And then I held local office before I ran for the state legislature. I was on a school board. I was a town supervisor. And I also served as a county supervisor as well. So the bug never really left me. And actually, it just this position became available. And I said, if I ever going to get involved in politics again, I want to go to the next level, which was the state legislature versus local government. And so when Craig Dorn, who was my predecessor, vacated the position, I put my name in the hat, and as they say, the rest is history.
Indeed. Do you ever see a time when the Republicans will, in blue state New York, take the assembly?
I think it would be very difficult for that to happen because of the such number dominance of, if you will, registered Democrats to Republicans in New York City. And really, you know, I think there's more opportunities for Assembly Republicans to grow their numbers, but it'll come from the suburbs or obviously in upstate. But it's very tough to win in the cities, which is where the greater population is because of the registration. So, but I think that every seat we add does make a difference, believe it or not, in committee substance and debates on the floor. Votes. We even have conservative Democrats that serve in the state assembly. And, you know, it makes it, as we add numbers, it becomes tougher for them to get to that 76 votes, especially on the more, what I'll call, liberal pieces of legislation
for
that
example,
might come through.
For example?
Well, for instance, same-sex marriage.
Sure.
What most people don't realize is that the time it finally passed in the Senate, in the Assembly, it only passed by 5 votes. And one of the differences, we had added another 9 members to the Republican conference, and all of them voted against same-sex marriage. So, and that, of course, shrinks the yes votes. And quite frankly, they had to have a couple of members, Assembly Democrat members, that had previously voted no on same-sex marriage, ask them to vote for it to help get the bill passed. So even though all the attention was focused on the state Senate, it was a lot closer in the state assembly than you would have thought. And that's what happens on some of these bills. And even the other day, we were debating micro-stamping. And
remind everybody what micro-stamping is.
Micro-stamping is a bill that's been proposed to try to etch some sort of code, tracing code, on a shell casing that's fired from a semi-automatic handgun.
Otherwise known as a bullet, okay.
Correct. And that bill only passed by 2 votes in the state assembly. Hmm. And in prior years, that the bill was first introduced in 2008, had passed by wider margins in the state assembly. Now, it hasn't gone anywhere in the state Senate.
Nor is it
going
to go.
Nor is it going to go. And, of course, I've said, why are we debating this bill again in the last week of session when we know it's not going anywhere? So, but that's a whole different conversation. But certainly, those are the types of circumstances. And even last year, there was a lot of bills that were a lot closer than people realized because we have increased our numbers. And the low point was February 2010, where we were down to 39 members, you know, because there were some vacancies in special elections. And we went from 39 to 51 at the completion of the election cycle in 2010. And that's a huge difference in the chamber for a lot of different reasons.
Tell me about your district a little bit. I'm always interested in that. You know, where is it geographically? Could you tell our listeners? I mean, here you are, the head of the Republicans in the Assembly, but all politics are local and where you come from. So tell us a little about home.
Well, the current district I represent is the 129th Assembly District, which includes parts of 4 counties, which is Ontario, which is where my home is, and Canandaigua. So that's Ontario County, all of Seneca County, and then parts of Cayuga County, Cortland County, and Onondaga County. So my district, from a west to east perspective, is from Canandaigua on the west, to the town of Fabius on the east, which borders Madison County. So it's almost 1,200 square miles.
So if you start at one end and go to the other, how long would it take you to drive it?
If I stay close to the speed limit,
right,
it takes about 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Well, it's not so bad.
But that's without stopping. And well, that's also traveling.
Men don't like to stop once they get into cars.
That's correct. But it also, I'm able to go at a pretty good clip on the thruway. But if I was to take all the back roads, it would take me much longer than that.
Wow. What kind of music do you like?
All kinds.
Really?
You know, I always wondered if someone was ever going to ask me, well, what would we find on your iPod?
Yeah.
And I say, everything. You know, I've got classical to rock to Eminem to country. It's I've got a very diverse interest in music.
Let me try to get you into a little bit of trouble here, which is my want. Obviously, the governor did not veto, chose not to veto the redistricting bill, which he promised he would. Now, clearly, had he vetoed that bill, the assembly minority would have been in better shape than had he not, because otherwise Shelley Silver gets to draw the districts. Did that tick you off?
Oh, it didn't tick me off because it wasn't expected that he'd veto. I never thought he'd veto.
Well, you thought he was a liar?
No, I just felt
didn't
he
you
never,
just say he was a liar?
No, I did not say that. So, good try, though. No, I never expected the governor to veto it.
He said he'd veto it.
I know
he swore he'd veto it. He said it again and again.
But he also said he wasn't going to raise taxes, and he did.
Uh-huh. Did he?
Absolutely.
How so?
The tax code changed last year in December of 2011. There was a middle-class tax cut in that bill, but the bill net raised taxes by $2 billion.
Oh, this is a piece of information that I think a lot of people don't know.
Well, that's because they sold that bill on the tax cut on the middle class, which amounted to about $3 a week. And they'll say, well, that was the largest middle-class tax cut in 58 years. But the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, is that it raised another $2 billion in revenues by they had increased the higher income tax brackets while the current 2009 version was in place before they expired. So, and they did all that before we got into the budget negotiations.
Let me try again. Don't you think it's morally repugnant and ethically repugnant for a governor to say, I'm going to veto that bill, run for office on that, and then not do it?
Well, my comment on that is that the voters have to decide whether that works for them or not. They make the ultimate decision.
Would you do it?
Would I do it? Me personally?
Yeah.
No, I would.
Would you go up and down your district and swear that you were going to do something, and then the first thing you do when you get in office is not do it?
Is reverse that course? I wouldn't, but that's me. Yeah. But, you know, there's politics in play here, as you know. And again, as a lot of people say, until you walk a mile in the shoes, you don't really know how the shoes fit. And I think the governor also is learning that, you know, he's probably going to be more reserved in terms of what he's going to do or not do in terms of saying something and then maybe reversing course later.
Well, but now he's in office, so he doesn't have to worry quite the way he might have in the beginning. In any case, we're talking to Minority Leader Brian Cole. We're delighted to have him here. He's the head of all the Republicans in the state assembly. Now, if there had been an outside group doing the districts, professors or graybeards or whoever was going to do it, do you think you guys would have picked up more seats?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And we had even produced, if you will, what we considered our own good government map for the assembly anyways, and submitted that to the assembly Democrats. And, of course, they rejected that. But we, in doing that exercise, we made districts a much more compact. In fact, it even created a couple additional minority districts in New York City. And then there were currently in the current plan.
Minority, not minority party, meaning minority ethnic or racial.
Ethnic or racial, correct. And so we know, and even if you go back 10 years ago, when they did redistricting 10 years ago, the Assembly Democrats took 4 to 5 seats away from out of a Republican count just by the stroke of a pen. So, yes, there's no doubt that I think if we had an outside independent group that was to do it fairly and actually along the ground rules that are established with towns and borders and all that and population deviation and all that, we would have fared much better.
You sat on a school board, so now there's a big debate as to whether parents are entitled to see the evaluations of teachers in the district. What do you think?
Well, I think that parents should have, as long as it's not a witch hunt, so to speak, that there's a very fair appraisal that has been worked out between the collective bargaining units, being the teachers, and the local school boards. And once that's established, is there a fair process in place that there's not an ability for a principal or even school superintendent to basically get his or her slant on things? In other words, it has to be a very fair process. And that's been, and that's the same situation in the private sector, quite frankly, is that I've had managers and supervisors work for me that weren't always fair and equitable in their reviews of their employees. And so you got to have a check and balance in the system to make sure that that's not happening. And I think that, in fairness, that if a teacher is having some real problems in the evaluation process in terms of their ability to teach, let's face it, you can say, I want to teach, but you may not be very good at it. It's no different in any profession. I may want to be a professional baseball player, but if I don't have the ability, you know, I shouldn't be trying to pursue that career. And so I think these are fair questions to ask, and as long as the evaluations are done fairly and the information is not jaded, then I think a parent has a right to know how that teacher is doing, not just with their student, but with all the students. But how many times, and I know you've probably heard this, there's, and I've been on the school board, and I've been a father of three children that went through school system, public school system, that parents talk about all the time. Boy, if you can get this teacher, that's great.
True.
And you want to avoid
absolutely true
that teacher.
That guy stands up there and talks about basketball games. You don't need that. This is the great teacher.
Correct. Now, I can also tell you that I've also had the experience where someone say, teacher A is really terrible. Stay away from him or her, right?
Right.
Another student has no choice, gets that teacher, and does magnificently. Mm-hmm. That's where you got to be careful, because each student is different. Students learn differently. Some teacher they may be inspired by. Another student just may not get it because they're not on the same plane of communication skills. And that's the tough part.
There's something called the Committee to Save New York. Everybody knows what it is. It's a cobbled together group with some very wealthy people who have been supporting the principles articulated by Andrew Cuomo. Do you think that our campaign finance laws are good enough to hold everybody responsible so that the voter can know who's behind the scenes passing out money and why?
I think we should have full disclosure on everybody. And
well, what does that mean? What do we have now, and what does that mean we should
have?
Well,
basically, like the Committee of to Save New York, just like the Google groups, the good government groups,
yeah, sure.
Don't disclose their donors, where they're getting their money from, the League of Women Voters, NYPIRG. To be perfectly frank, I'd like to see who's giving them their money.
NYPIRG?
All of them.
Oh, I see.
Because when they're pushing a political agenda, we've at least had some experiences at different times that some of these groups are pushing a very, what I'll call, more liberal agenda versus truly a good government agenda. And so I'm saying the rules should be the same for everybody. If you're donating to whatever effort, you should disclose the individual's name or the company name or whoever it is, then everybody knows, and you can then make your own judgments whether it's good or bad.
Should we decriminalize marijuana to the point where, you know, it's a ticket, a $100 ticket, as opposed to being stopped and frisked and potentially put into the criminal justice system?
No, I do not. I think that, quite frankly—
I'm shocked, I tell you, really shocked.
Well, I say that because I've talked to the professionals that are trying to help people with addictions. And they unanimously will say this: people don't realize how much of a problem that marijuana is to get people down the wrong road in terms of
a gateway drug.
Even, and they say, I'm talking about the professionals now, I'm not talking about political opinions, that they feel it's still more of a problem than alcohol is, even though they don't like alcohol either. So, and I've said all along on marijuana, you want to have this debate, let's have it at the federal level. If we want to have medical marijuana, fine, but that should be authorized through the Food and Drug Administration, have it regulated just like we do every other prescription drug, and then it's the same in all 50 states. And really, if you talk to people even where they do have medical marijuana, California, I think even Colorado, it's a joke. People are feigning, you know, that they're in pain just so that they can go in and buy marijuana. So if we're really going to talk about this from a serious perspective, And also, it's currently a federal offense to possess marijuana. So that's in conflict with our federal laws. And the only difference is the federal folks are not spending their time and effort arresting people because they have bigger fish to fry. And quite frankly, as you know, this whole thing started with the stop and frisk.
Yeah, tell us about that. The minorities in New York, many, are now saying, look, my kid walks down the street, the chances of his being stopped and frisked is much greater than if it happens to be a white kid in the same clothes from the same school.
Absolutely, and that's the way it shouldn't be. It should be, if you're going to have a stop and frisk program, it's, you know, okay, what are you making those decisions on? And with this whole possession of marijuana, what they're saying is that when they're stopping and frisking people because of suspicious behavior or being in places they don't think they should be in, they were finding that when they emptied their pockets, they had marijuana, and then under current law, they'd have to be charged with a misdemeanor. What I've said in that particular case is just what the federal folks are doing is the New York City police officers could ignore that. They don't have to arrest them. They could, if you will, look the other way. It's just like sometimes.
But that gives them, Brian, that gives them a lot more discretion, and discretion sometimes kills the cat because, you know, again, a pretty woman or somebody who is of a paler complexion gets away with it. And if you were black and your kid was regularly stopped on the street, you wouldn't like it very much.
Well, of course not. And that's, again, where you have to have honest-to-goodness discussions with the police department, with the mayor's office, with the community activists to say, okay, what makes sense? Because ultimately, it's about keeping your neighborhood safe.
So it's sort of don't ask, don't tell?
Yeah, I think it's, to some extent it might work better. But if you're talking about a possession of a marijuana joint versus a 16 ounces, which is a sandwich plastic bag full, that's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, you're talking about having the ability to carry up to 25 grams of marijuana, which is a little over an ounce, I should say, of pot. That's where I think it just goes too far the other way.
Have you ever smoked pot?
Can we go to another question?
Okay. So let me ask you this. The Republican Party, many people now feel, have been taken over by what some people call the loopies in these primaries, the right-wing guys. That's not the New York State Republican Party, I know. And I'm wondering whether or not you agree with that.
No, I don't think the parties. I think all elections are local, whether it's, you know, village, town, county, state legislature. There's more activist groups in different parts of the state in a given locale than it is a statewide.
Yeah, but I'm talking about showing up for a primary. It would appear that the right-wing candidates are winning over the moderate Republican candidates. What my mother would say, we're the best kind, the moderates.
Well, again, the only thing that they're representing is they're getting votes from people that apparently agree with their positions on the issues.
But very few people show up in these primaries, right? So that the activists tend to carry the day.
Well, I think if you look at the, again, each district is different. And so I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I'm also saying that being someone that's had experience in a primary, I've had a primary not from a, it's just a local primary that I had, and you just have to work and get your message out and meet people. And that's no different than anything. So I think it's not taking over. I still maintain the guy or lady that wins just did a better job of meeting people and getting, even if it's a smaller number of folks, they've just done a better job of getting the vote out for them.
Well, Brian Cole, we're almost out of time, but could a Jacob Javits or Ken Keating win in the Republican Party today?
I think so.
Our guest has been the remarkable minority leader of the New York State Assembly, Republican Brian Cole, who represents the 129th District. Brian, you're always welcome before these microphones. You're a terrific guy. Thanks so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.